Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The Biden administration last week submitted its first and much delayed and much anticipated 2022 defense budget request to Congress, asking for $715 billion to reshape U.S. forces to better deter China and Russia. The measure prioritized research and development, as well as classified and nuclear modernization programs, improving pay and benefits, investing in infrastructure and paring back acquisition efforts, and retiring aging systems to free investments for new systems. Of that amount, the administration is asking for $212.8 billion for the U.S. Air Force. That includes nearly $40 billion in pass-through funding not controlled by the service for largely classified national efforts, a $7.3 billion or 3.3% increase over the 2021 budget of $205 billion, roughly flat given inflation. The Space Force budget is up at $17.4 billion. The ground-based strategic deterrent, B-21 bomber, long-range standoff missile, as well as nuclear command and control programs maintain support as the administration works to modernize the nation's strategic deterrent arms. Research and development spending is up while acquisition spending is down, as the service is looking to retire 221 older aircraft, including A-10 attack planes, KC-135, and KC-10 tankers, as well as C-130 transports, again, to free spending on new programs. The F-35 acquisitions remain in place, as does KC-46, although the MH-139 Grey Wolf helicopter acquisition was suspended. The Grey Wolf is built by our sponsor, Leonardo, in partnership with Boeing. Although the administration argues that air and sea power are vital to better deter China and Russia, the Air Force's core budget of $156 billion is roughly on par with that of the U.S. Army. Joining us now to discuss the Air and Space Force budgets, budget requests are John Turpak of Air Force Magazine and Todd Harrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I should note, both are former airmen who are among the world's leading experts on the United States Air Force and the United States Space Force. John and Todd, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Good to be here.
And we are all of a generation that I can say aim high, and that doesn't miss the mark. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And General Motors Defense is sponsoring our technology coverage. Guys, thanks very much for joining us. This is the second in a series of service breakdowns. Yesterday, we heard from Brian McGrath and our very own Chris Cavas on the Navy budget. John, start us off. What do you make of this budget? What stood out to you? And sort of more broadly, what did they get right and what did they get wrong?
Well, I think the key thing here, this is the first big down payment on C.Q. Brown's Accelerate, Change, or Lose program, where he wants to take out legacy systems that are either no longer relevant or too expensive to make relevant in a timely fashion, and apply the savings toward modernization programs, either buying new things we already know how to make or developing new systems that are not yet to the production stage. The thing that's going to draw a lot of attention on Capitol Hill is this is at the Air Force's own admission. This is a risky budget. You're letting go of something you already have before you have hold of something new. And a lot of members of Congress don't like that. It takes out a lot of airplanes, a lot of systems, but confounding some of the naysayers, it absolutely preserves all the strategic modernization that some were worried was going to be a bill payer for the rest.
And which point out, right, 48 F-35s are in there, 12 F-15 EXs, which is slightly less. Am I right, John? Did that get dialed
back? No, that's that was what was programmed before. But we at Air Force Magazine were able to get some out years planning information, which was not included in this budget. We didn't get the FYDP numbers, the Future Years Defense Program. And the Air Force is planning to take out quite a few more airplanes over the next 5 years, 421 fighters, actually. replacing them with just 304 new ones. And that also is going to, I think, raise a lot of eyebrows on Capitol Hill.
And again, right, I mean, this budget is seen to try to reposition the nation, its air forces, space, land, sea forces, for the kind of challenges we're going to be facing in the future. And it's even reflected right down to the munitions level. Todd, what was your sense on the budget? What stood out for you? And also, since you're one of the leading analysts on the Space Force, you know, what did you make of this Space Force budget, you know, with the fledgling new organization that Jay Raymond and General Thompson are looking to firm up?
Yeah, so I would say overall, looking at the Air Force side of the Department of the Air Force budget, what stood out to me is that every single title within the Air Force's budget saw an increase in nominal terms from the current level of funding, with the exception of procurement. O&M was up, RDT&E was up, MILPERS was up, MILCON, you know, family housing and all that was up. It was just procurement that took a hit, and it took a big hit of over $3 billion from the current level of funding. Now, a better comparison, though, of course, is how did they do in the FY22 request compared to what was previously projected for FY22. And so I looked program by program, and for a lot of programs, even though their funding may have increased, it was increasing in line with what was already projected. You know, the B-21 is right in line with what was previously projected. The F-35A, buying 48 planes as previously projected for this year. That is less than last year, but only because Congress keeps adding them. But with the F-35, we saw an increase of about $600 million in RDT&E funding that hadn't previously been projected. The KC-46 is in line with projections, the F-15EX, GBSD, you name it. The two that stand out on the Air Force side to me are LRSO, so the long-range standoff weapon, a new nuclear-armed cruise missile. It saw an increase of almost double from what was previously projected. So they appear to be accelerating, moving ahead quickly with that program. The other one that stood out in the Air Force is ABMS, so the Airborne Battle Management, the Advanced Battle Management System, which is the Air Force's implementation of JADC2 for Joint All Domain Command and Control. That program got cut by more than half from what was previously projected for FY22. So that is a definite sign of issues on that program, or lack of support right now within the Air Force, worthy of some more discussion. But, you know, in terms of the Space Force budget, it was an increase, but not as much of an increase as you might think. If you look into what actually went up in funding, so a number of programs were just increasing as had previously been projected, like Next Generation OPIR. That program is up to almost $2.5 billion a year. The National Security Space Launch Program, they're touting that as an increase, but that was previously planned. They had already planned to buy 5 launches in this year, and GPS-3 follow-on satellites as well, touting that as an increase, but they're just buying the number that was already planned. And, you know, within the increase in the Space Force's budget, over $600 million of it is transfers. It's not new funding. It's transfers from the other services as the Army and the Navy continue to move some of their people and their organizations and programs into the Space Force.
And you've joined us to discuss whether or not the Space Force is getting everything that it wants, or just merely absorbing stuff that the other services don't. I don't want to necessarily get too bogged down in that. John, let me ask you about the ABMS, right? I mean, the Air Force former chief Goldfein was one of the intellectual fathers of the idea of a JADC2, certainly sold the joint force on the concept. It looks like it was being backed with something the service has been working toward. And yet it appears that support for that seems to be faltering, right? The Army and the Air Force have agreed to work together to try to get to JADC2 with the Navy sort of dotted line. You know, we're going to do our own thing, but we'll manage to come in and join you later a position that's been criticized, right? I mean, this is going to be successful if everybody is connecting at base from word go, as opposed to developing their own architectures that we're trying to connect, which is you know, a big part of the current problem. How do you view the outlook for ABMS at this point, right? Is it a temporary pause? Is this a U-turn, right? I mean, all of these plans and out year depend on whatever the administration concludes in its national security strategy, its national defense strategy, right? So 2023 is going to be the budget with the biggest muscle movements in it, as opposed to this one. But I just wanted to get, you know, your sense on where you think all of this is going after years of intellectual effort and rhetoric.
Sure. Sure. Well, clearly, ABMS, still a very, very high priority for the Air Force. I think we're passing now from the phase of prototyping and development into how can we turn this into hardware that we can show a congressman and say, look, there it is. It's a thing. Let's buy it. That's a difficult transition period for the Air Force right now. I also think there are some clues in Frank Kendall's answers to questions from the Senate Armed Services Committee. He didn't give a whole lot of high protein answers because he's not allowed to perform the duties before he performs the duties. But he did point out that joint programs have abysmal track record. And he suggested, particularly in C2, one service needs to be the lead and the other services simply buy what that service comes up with. And I think that's probably going to be the politics from this point on. It's getting everybody, as you say, singing off the same sheet of music.
I should point out, right, the service is still spending $204 million, which, John, I just want to commend to everybody. One of the best articles on this is your article that's in Air Force Magazine, and the team has done a terrific job in covering it, as you said, even with some of the out-year numbers. And that constitutes an increase of $46 million, right? So it's still quite a bit of money that's going to this.
It is, but it's not a program, say, on the scale of the Next Generation Air Dominance airplane, which went from nearly $1 billion to about $1.5 billion, big increase there. So I think Congress is also going to be looking at the Air Force and saying, well, geez, are you putting your money where your mouth is?
Well, and for perspective here, you know, the Air Force had planned to ramp up to over $450 million for ABMS this year. So coming right in at $204 million is a big cut. But it's also worth noting, as John said, the Air Force has got to do a better job of explaining exactly what they're building here. What are we buying with this money? Because last year, Congress cut the request for ABMS significantly. And, you know, one of the big questions that's out there is, okay, what is it? ABMS has evolved quite a bit. I mean, it started out as a JSTARS recapitalization alternative, right? We don't need to buy new planes to do the JSTARS mission. We're going to, you know, do it some other way. Okay, what is that? You know, are you buying a radar with this? Are you buying communication systems? You know, are you buying software? And that's where I think the Air Force has not really defined it very well for Congress so that they can understand what they're buying. The other thing I would point out to your point earlier about, you know, how do you do this? Is JADC2, should it be a joint program of some kind? Or should, you know, one service lead and the others follow? I think the root issue we have across DoD right now is that no single service has been designated as the lead for the JADC2 mission. And until they do that, you're going to have each service going off in its own direction. They will ultimately develop stovepipe systems, and we'll be lucky if they can even connect all of their own forces within their domain, much less connect across services, across domains, and connect with allies and partners. So that is something that the DoD leadership, the secretary and the deputy secretary, have to get a handle on right away. They've got to do a miniature roles and missions review. They've got to designate someone as the lead service for building JADC2 and then direct all the other services, be compatible with that, buy that system.
I should point out, right, that such roles and missions reviews are going to be necessary, especially since everybody is getting into the deeper strike business, right? I mean, so we're going to have to create some rules of the road when the Navy is shooting hypersonics in the same theater as is the Army, as is the Marine Corps, and as the Air Force that tends to be the center of air operations, or at least lead air operations, and in a JFAC or CFAC capability, that a capacity. I think that that's going to be very important to do.
And also they've got, you know, roles and missions problems when it comes to things like base defense. Whose job is
correct?
That? Does the Air Force correct. Need to build its own base defense systems, or is the Army going to do that for the Air Force for these forward air bases?
Well, I mean, and right, and that's the reason why folks have said that Aegis Ashore in Guam is almost like a Dante Inferno thing, right? You have to get the Army to buy a Navy system to defend the Air Force, right? So go ahead and try to figure out the politics of that. By the way, Todd, I'm going to assail you a little bit. It is a reduction in the rate of increase, right? It's not, you know what I mean? It's still an increase in ABMS. It's just not as large as it was programmed to That's increase, right? So, yep. You know, so in real terms, it's more money. In plan terms, it's a cut. I had this discussion recently with a senator and a couple of congressmen, and they finally acknowledged that something was not really a cut that we were talking about.
But when you see that happen, when you see that something was planned to ramp up to a certain level and then it doesn't when the year comes around, then you do have to ask the question, what's going on? And I think at this point in the budget rollout, we don't yet know what's going on within the right. Air Force and why they made this change, but we know that there is a change.
Let me ask about the weapons portfolio, right? Because there are some folks who are looking at JDAM cuts, you know, and a hypersonic increase. John, talk to us about almost the generational transition we might be watching here in terms of the Air Force gearing up and preparing for an entirely different fight than not only it was doing in Iraq and Afghanistan, but actually has been doing for the decades before, that some of the fundamental power projection elements of air power may be changing before our eyes under the leadership of C.Q. Brown and the team.
Right. Well, this budget contains, I think it's almost 88% reduction in the JDAM production. When you go back 3 years to the high water mark, it's more than a 95% reduction. The JDAM is almost a direct line of sight gravity fall weapon, and that's not going to be what the Air Force needs in the future. This morning, I was talking about this with Mark Gunzinger from the Mitchell Institute, celebrated author of many papers on the right mix of munitions for the Air Force. And he said that he applauds the Air Force's move away from direct attack munitions and towards this budget includes an increase in JASSM-ER, which is a stealthy long-range munition. But there are thousands of aim points in the Pacific theater, and you'll never buy enough JASMs to hit all of those. So I suspect that there's more to this story than meets the eye right now. I suspect that there is well in development a reduced signature weapon, maybe from a little further out than the JDAM range, but something still to be seen.
Todd?
Yeah, and you know, some of the reductions that we're seeing now in shorter range munitions is really just a reflection of we were burning through a lot of these items in previous years in the war against, you know, ISIS and what we were doing in Afghanistan. We were just burning through these things rapidly. And so we were buying a lot of replacements after the fact to restock our inventories. We've reached a point where we're not burning through them like we were before. The usage rate is way down and we have largely replenished our inventories, so we don't need to keep buying them at such a high level. Another factor here is historically, if you look back, when budgets get tight and they're looking to make cuts, munitions tend to be an easy place to go. Because you can just dial down the production rate a bit and free up some money that you can use to fill other holes in your budget. And you know, a lot of other procurements, especially programs that are in development, you can't just dial them like a rheostat without having long-term consequences. But things that are in steady production, you do have a bit of range in your rheostat to move them up and move them down when you need to.
Yeah, when you ask the Air Force, their response as to why they slashed JDAM production is, we're comfortable with where our stockpile is. We've been rebuilding for a couple of years. We feel comfortable moving that money over to R&D of new systems.
Let me ask two questions. We have a new secretary who is in the confirmation process, Frank Kendall, the former Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Logistics, and Technology, Acquisition Technology and Logistics, ATNL, before the job was obviously broken up by Senator McCain to try to make a more responsive community of ANS and R&E, Acquisition and Sustainment and Research and Engineering. John, you have heard a lot of confirmation hearings. What jumped out at you, and what do you think Secretary Kendall's priorities should be? We should note he's a retired United States Army officer, West Point graduate, but also somebody who's deeply familiar, right? I mean, was one of the founders of the NGAD effort, in fact, as a DARPA program, right? When under his tenure as ATNL. You know, give us a sense on what are the messages you heard from him during this hearing that you think are most interesting, that will have the most needle-moving implications. And Todd, I want to get your sense on this as well. You know, and I should note that all of us know Frank Kendall really, really well and is an exemplary individual.
Yeah, well, of course, as is always the case in confirmation hearings, a lot of his answers were very safe, not controversial, but he did mention that he wants to get better control over sustainment costs on the F-35. That's absolutely essential if that airplane is still to be the cornerstone, as the Air Force says, of the fighter force for the foreseeable future. He's very much in favor of new technologies. He certainly echoed a lot of the things that we heard from Bob Work in the last administration on the third offset technologies. What are going to be the game-changing technologies of the future? So I think you'll see a lot of push in those directions. And he also seems to take very personally the need to clean up the service in terms of sexual assault and extremism in the ranks. He was visibly passionate about that in the hearings, and I would expect to see movement along a broad front there.
And John, talk to us a little bit about what Frank had to say about returning to a Cold War mindset and approach that may be necessary, because that may have some sweeping industrial and programmatic implications.
Sure. Well, he said in a very oblique fashion that it may be time to rethink the ways we buy some of the essential materials for war readiness stocks. He suggested that maybe we ought to go back to dual sourcing things like radars, engines, missiles, bombs, as we did back in the 1980s, to assure that there is a capacity for surge production. And he didn't say it, but the benefit of that is also you get some competition, and competition frequently drives better products at a lower price.
Todd?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what we can take away from Frank Kendall's hearing is that, you know, as we all expected, he's a professional. He understands the Pentagon. He understands the Air Force. He understands the acquisition system very well. He's going to be a steady hand at the wheel in many ways. And he'll be coming in at a time where he will be able to, reap the fruits of some of his acquisition reform efforts when he was at ATNL, a few years back. Because, you know, as we all know, been in the industry, you can change things in the acquisition system, and it may look great now, but really you're not going to know if it is having a good effect for, you know, 4, 5, 6 years down the road. So he'll be coming in at a time where, you know, he will be seeing the impact of some of the changes he made in acquisitions and Air Force programs in particular. So I think we should expect that he is going to take, you know, a keen interest in the acquisition side of the Air Force. I imagine he'll be spending a lot of his time right away dealing with issues on the F-35 program, dealing with, you know, NGAD and how that program is going to be ramping up and proceeding, and especially the acquisition strategy that Will Roper set up for that program, the non-traditional, let's say, acquisition strategy for NGAD, where you keep recompeting it every few years and buy a bunch of small fleets of aircraft. So, you know, he's going to have issues to work through like that, you know, with the Air Force, but I don't think that he will be someone who, you know, makes wild changes one way or the other, or tries, you know, to implement, you know, unconventional, untraditional acquisition approaches.
Let me ask one last question, right? C.Q. Brown, that somebody who's preached something very similar, right? Accelerate change or lose. It's certainly great to have that message and have somebody who is trying to push the force to change and to change faster. But some of his comments, you know, people were saying, oh, the F-22 will be retired. Well, yes, eventually the F-22 will be retired, just like the B-52 at some point will be retired. Just like at some point there will be no flying DC-3s either. It's just that date is really somewhat more in the future at this point. And the chief has gotten some criticism also, not just for the comments he's made about F-35, but also Q Highnote and others in the service have sort of made disparaging comments about the F-35. And there are those who are just concerned that, hey, don't shoot the bird in hand for two potentially in the bush, because you might actually end up with no more fifth generation fighters at the end of the day. Is the Air Force getting its messaging right on a program that's core, given that even if we want to do NGAD fast, it is unlikely we will do it as fast as some people imagine it to be? It's sort of like, hey, let's destroy the planet because we can go to Mars. You're not going to Mars anytime soon. So, you know what I mean? I just want to get your sense on, is the Air Force sort of getting over the tips of its skis on the F-35 program, whatever concerns it may have with it, which are legitimate, right? I mean, and obviously need to be addressed.
Well, I think the Air Force has been trying to tell the message that they want the F-35, but at a sustainment cost that they can afford, the one that they planned for, which was probably overly optimistic. And also they want the Block 4 version of the airplane, which really doesn't start rolling off the assembly line for a couple of years. So they're kind of taking on airplanes in the meantime at the minimum rate they think they can get away with and keep the price where they want it and keep those airplanes upgradable. But yeah, when you have three or four or five different kind of messages all at once, they're going to get muddy. And that's the problem with the Air Force. They really haven't found a bumper sticker for how they feel about the F-35.
Well, and
last thoughts.
Yeah, it is difficult to make the argument that you need to continue with production of a fifth gen fighter when you are restarting production of a fourth gen fighter in the F-15EX, because it's, you know, can do the mission of the older F-15s you want to retire at a lower cost than the F-35. And then at the same time, you're ramping up on a sixth gen fighter program in NGAD. That is a lot for Congress to swallow. And so I think the Air Force has really got to slow down and tune their message. And I think the comments about the F-22 retirement, I think they were taken out of context in the press, but the Air Force should have known better than to put that out there without providing the additional details of we'll retire it sometime in the distant future, not in the next 10 years. They could have provided a little more guidance like that, so it's a bit of an unforced error. But this is going to be a difficult, you know, needle to thread.
I do think it's interesting that right after some of those comments, this budget includes money to update the F-22 as well as the B-52. This notion of legacy, I think it's not a right measure, right? Everybody says like, well, we have to get rid of legacy. That's not necessarily true. You want to get rid of the things that may not actually be as useful and you may have something that is a legacy platform that actually could be very useful to you, like the B-52, for example. But what very last question, and you guys each get 30 seconds on this. Do you think that Congress is going to intervene to change any elements of this budget? Really briefly, John, and then Todd.
I think you'll get some pushback on the numbers of aircraft that the Air Force wants to retire. You'll certainly get questions for the Air Force on ABMS. And I think the strategic modernization is going to go forward.
Todd.
I think that a lot of the divestments will probably be blocked by Congress unless the department leadership intervenes directly and forcefully, which it doesn't look like they're prepared to do. And so I think Congress will end up scrounging around and probably adding a little more money than has been requested here for the Air Force, but also for the other services as well, to put back some of these divestments and to fund some of the unfunded priorities that have been submitted to Congress.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. Always a pleasure having you on.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.